think it was on my phone, was the problem. And this, you were talking about the Shah's, there were concerns in the Kennedy administration about the Shah's ability to absorb military weapons, military purchases that he wanted to make. What were those concerns clearly expressed at that time?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
This was one concern. It was a continuing concern with all of the administrations, as a matter of fact. I think that in the Kennedy days and up until the Nixon days, there were other concerns in certain parts of the U.S. government about the role that the military would have in Iran, what its true needs were in terms of defense, and so forth. So it wasn't just absorptive capacity, or it wasn't just the financial resources available, but there were a complex of considerations. But certainly, one of the overriding ones that we made with the Shah, and indeed that we made with big many of his advisors and so forth, which was accepted to a certain degree, was, you know, how rapidly can we take this stuff on once we have it? Not only the question of just learning how to use it, but maintenance, which is a very critical part. And then the management of the back end of weapon systems, the spare parts, and replacement, etc. So again, it's, you know, when you get into it in depth, why it's more than just a simple question of needs or desires or capability. A lot of that aspect to it.
But in any case, during this period, the Kennedy administration's policy was to closely monitor what the Shah would buy and how much he would spend on military. Was that the thrust of policy?
Well, it was closely monitored in the sense that our response to their requests were contingent upon our assessment of their total governmental activity, which got into the economic development field and questions of taxes and, well, the whole, just the whole government activity, and that we would make a judgment about our response to their requests on the basis of our analysis of what was happening elsewhere in the economy, as well as in the strictly security field. So we were almost, you might say, part of their budgetary planning process on a post facto basis, not on an ongoing basis, but on a post facto basis, and say, okay, here's what they've set aside for this and this and this and this, and this is where the gap is, and how much of it are we prepared to fill? And we weren't going to do anything until we had this analysis completed.
But was the Shah, did the Shah accept this sort of grudgingly, this sort of procedure, or was it, did they just...
Well, obviously it was accepted because we did work with the Iranian government officials, the Iranian government officials, and developing the kind of information we needed to come up with our own analysis. What his directions were to his ministers, I have no way of knowing. And the assumption is, he said, well, give the Americans what they're asking for, etc. I don't recall that we ever hammered out in detail, and as a matter of fact, I rather doubt that we did, what it was that we wanted the Iranian government to provide us, or what we intended to do. I think that our approach was to the Shah, I'm talking about, was a broader, more generalized, you know, Your Majesty, in order for us to be responsive to your and your government's requests, we feel obligated to our own people and to our Congress to be able to answer questions about the legitimacy of what we're going to be doing here. And to do this, while we have to have information about what your budgetary resources are and the sources of those resources and what your expenditure patterns are and so forth. And that if you would be good enough to direct your ministers to and their subordinates to cooperate with this line, would be gratified.
During the months after this military aid program was worked out, the Shah, I think towards the end of 62, announced his White Revolution program. In early 63, mm-hmm. had a national referendum mm-hmm. on the six-point program for land reform and
right.
literacy reform and so forth, educational reform, mm-hmm. administrative reform, and so forth. Mm-hmm. What was the U.S.'s, the State Department's response to it, or the U.S. government's response to this sort of sweeping reform program?
Well, there was mixed feelings about it. People in Washington felt that this was just a PR operation and a sop to the Americans who were pressing for reform and progress. Others felt that it was unrealistic and grandiose. And certainly too ambitious. Yet others thought that this was an enlightened framework for moving forward toward goals that both we and Iran felt were desirable. You can't really characterize, say, well, the Washington reaction was this yeah. or that. It was mixed.
And the State Department had sort of an official response?
No response was called for, really.
Yeah.
But I think that, by and large, certainly I personally and most of the people that I dealt with at my level in Washington, in the State Department itself, felt that this was a reasonably good thing. I remember personally I had some reservations about the agricultural land reform program because of the inherent limitations on its implementation. That you had to think of this as a very long-term thing, that you can't do it overnight, that there are all kinds of things involved when you remove the landlord from the setup. Then you have to have a number of things to replace what the landlord, landowners, did, which they provided the financing and the seed and the water and the technology to the extent that it existed, the marketing facilities. Now you take him away from that and you have to have something to replace it, and this is a very complicated, difficult thing to do, requiring a lot of organization, requiring institutions, requiring manpower, and requiring natural resources. So, you know, if you want to say even I was dubious about it. I was dubious about that aspect of it for those reasons. Not that I didn't think in the long term this was the right thing, but just in terms of its effectiveness and the timing.
I have the impression that during this period, early 63, there was some debate in Washington as to how far the U.S. should push or support the Shah and put some pressure on the Shah to go forward with the land reform program. There was some debate over whether the U.S. should press the Shah to go further with these programs or take a more rigorous approach to reform.
There were people in our government speaking specifically of government, who I would characterize as more ideologues than really practical practitioners of the process of development and modernization, who felt just, you know, conceptually these were good things and they ought to be done and they ought to be done right now. And all of you bureaucrats that are, talking about the impediments or the limitations and so forth, you're just unimaginative and unresponsive and, get out of our way. This wasn't necessarily a prevailing opinion, but it was a strong one. There were those that said, you know, we ought to tell the Shah to do this, we ought to tell the Shah to do that, and sort of a rather long laundry list of things we ought to tell him to do. And our argument, counter-argument was, what if he doesn't agree? What's our fallback position? First, you've antagonized him, we know that for sure. And if he doesn't agree, then what do? If we retreat, why then we've tarnished our flag, and this is not going to redound to our benefit. So there was this kind of debate back and forth, almost unceasingly.
Yeah, apparently, I guess Kenneth Hansen and Robert Comer especially argued that with the embassy in Iran, Ambassador Holmes in particular, were taking a passive approach to the problem of reform, but they were not taking an active interventionist role as they should. How did Holmes respond to those kinds of arguments? Do you know? Did you get a sense of his feeling about those criticisms?
Basically said that this is not the way you conduct diplomatic affairs or foreign relations between two sovereign states. And that we could seriously damage our long-term objectives and goals there by taking this approach. Furthermore, if we were seen to be, or the perception gained credibility among the Iranians themselves, that this was basically an American enterprise, that it would be discredited from the outset, and there would be no chance at all of it having any success. And very much against this. I recall one instruction that was basically drafted by Bob Comer or whoever in the NSC, but I think probably by Bob, telling Julius Holmes, Ambassador Holmes, that, you know, to do this and that and the other thing vis-a-vis the Shah. And I don't know if Phil Talbot told you about this. I remember the incident, though. And he showed me the message, and I said, you can't sign off on that and send that to Julius Holmes. And he said, in effect, he said, well, I just don't really have any option.
Was it White House order, sort of?
So the telegram went, and we got a very strong message back from Julius, who's no patsy, about the impropriety of the contents of the message, as well as the tone. It was a bad scene. But, in effect, he said, don't tell Grandma how to suck eggs.
I don't want to know. But, now, shortly after these events, I guess in June of 63, there was a demonstrations and sort of an uprising in many cities across Iran against the Shah's reform program. This is June of 63. Were you still at the company desk at this point, in June of 63?
No, I had left by then, just left, yeah. But I think I left in April or May. Uh-huh. Of course, I was very much aware of what was going on. And so while I wasn't on the desk, I knew a lot of the, not only the issues, but the personalities involved. And basically what it was the clergy's sort of last confrontation with the Shah, certainly the last before of any significance before 1978. They had very serious misgivings about his so-called Shah People Revolution, or White Revolution, I think he called it in those days. On sort of two basic grounds. One was, of course, that it directly affected their power and influence. When you take which derived from their ownership of land and income from those lands, and the fact that this, some of that was going to be taxed, which hadn't been the case before, it diminished greatly their influence over the educational system and process in the country. It introduced into the society Western concepts and people that were sympathetic to the those concepts, Western custom practice, if you will, including a more a democratic life for women in the country. Women's lives was a term that we familiar with in those days, but that was the import of some of the things that he proposed. And this deeply affected and offended their sense of propriety and morality. This, them meaning the fundamental religious clergy. And there was also, they were joined by some of the bazaaris that were heavily influenced by the clergy, but felt some of their own self-interest would be affected by this. So there was this confrontation, and Ayatollah Khomeini was very much a part of this at the time, and subsequently, as we know, was deported.
You said during our break that you heard later on about some of the decision-making process where the trial decided to go for policy repression against the demonstrations. What did you learn?
Yes, well, I learned subsequently. Apparently there was, the Shah was not really that he was struggling with how to deal with these demonstrators and demonstrations and what policy to follow. That it was, I believe, his minister of court at the time, at least he was certainly his, one of his closest advisors, Mr. Alam, who argued successfully, it turned out, that this was a very serious matter, that it was a direct challenge to the authority of the Shah, and that he had to, in effect, cut bait, whatever the term is, his only solution, if he was to survive, was to call out the military and face these people down, which he did, and there was naturally some bloodshed, and although the numbers involved remain in dispute, doubtless there were some people killed and others wounded. But he carried the day. The military obviously remained loyal. And he really never looked back after that in terms of confrontation with the mullahs in any direct sense until 1978.
Did you learn about this affair from Alam himself or one of his associates? Or?
One of his associates, who certainly knew. As a matter of fact, I think it was then Prime Minister Hoveyda that told him. He was also a close personal friend of mine.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the overall decision-making process in, under Kennedy, did you get a sense that that Rusk had much interest in Iranian affairs or much involvement at all in any given moment? Or
no. No, I did not get the impression at my low level anyhow,
yeah,
that that the secretary was closely involved or interested in Iranian affairs. Was more in those days it was left to basically to Phil Talbot and some other people at that level in the State Department. And defense played a, insofar as the military program is concerned, they had a very strong voice in affairs.
Who were the, did you have any people at the Pentagon who worked on Iran? Do you recall any names? Or?
We're talking the early 60s now.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry, I can't remember names. I did deal with them, all right, because the economic and military system things were interrelated.
Was Henry Cuss around then?
Yeah, well, this is a name that I certainly know.
Was
it then or later?
I think he, all through the 60s, I think he was involved in arms sales issues for the Pentagon. Pretty early in the administration.
In the Kennedy?
Henry Cuss, I think, yeah. I think. And through Johnson. And then until the end of Johnson. I might be mistaken.
Well, it's certainly a familiar name.
Yeah.
There were several people that were involved then and subsequently that I came into contact with. And I'm sorry, my...
Yeah.
The chronology escapes me at the moment. Cuss was certainly involved at one point or another. I just don't remember the point.
Yeah. So the Talbot.
I remember one example. It's about under the previous administration, the United States had agreed to provide Iran with a couple of frigate sites, as I recall, and they had been retrofitted. At some expense for Iran, and the new administration came into office.
This is from Carter to Reagan.
Eisenhower
to
Eisenhower
to Kennedy.
Kennedy.
Okay, I'm
sure. We're in that.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. I want to make sure.
And I argued almost every way I knew how that, you know, the administration decided they didn't want to send a ship through, they'd get the ship through, rather we go back on the promise or commitment of the previous administration. And, you know, I argued the politics of it, the morality of it, everything else, and nothing seemed to matter. Well, I finally sent a memo, or wrote a memo, which we sent over to McNamara. In effect saying, look, we've spent X million dollars on this. These things are configured to Iranian specifications. You know, nobody else is going to take them. We're just throwing this money down the drain. Money was the answer. Well, and Comer, well, if McNamara's on board buying, it was all very grudgingly done, but it was on that basis, not on the basis of, you know, what you think of national interests or, you know, keeping previous administration commitments or anything else. It was just the fact that we spent this money and, you know, in other words, it was going to be a waste. That's how some of these things work.
Yeah. But in terms of decision-making, Talbot was a key figure. Were there other high-level officials who played a role? Was Harriman much involved in Iranian issues?
Well, as I said, and I again can't remember the name, but there were a couple of people over in defense, IS, whoever was head of ISA in those days, and one step below that, that had the Near East and South Asian watch for ISA, and the services sort of got in and out of it a little bit, but not too much. And even once in a while, you get the Joint Chiefs' attention for a while. But, you know, on an ongoing basis, a lot of ISA Assistant Secretary in the Pentagon.
For international security affairs.
The IMF, head of IMF, and the guy who was responsible for the Near East and South Asian affairs in the IMF, not the IMF, Export Import Bank, sorry. IMF's not U.S. government, export, but we got a lot of money from the Export Import Bank in those days. Aid, and the section, again, that dealt with the Near East and South Asian affairs. Department of Agriculture, to the extent the PO 480 programs were important, and they were in those days, although that tended to be a somewhat lower level, generally not the assistant secretary, but say the deputy. Who else? Within the department itself, of course, the regional bureau we talked about, and the assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of economic affairs.
Was Abel Harriman ever involved in any issues?
Not in any sustained way at all. He did dip in and out once or twice in Iranian affairs, and I recall discussing Iranian affairs with his assistant, Sam Lewis, who was carrying out Harriman's instructions. But it seemed to me, my impression was not so much intervention in the direction that policy was going, but more, what's going on. Find out what, ask the regional people what's happening in Iran or what the jobs are, that kind of thing, rather than saying, we ought to be doing this or we ought to be doing that. Although I think Harriman had, fairly strong views about military assistance, meaning that he thought the Shah maybe was going too far, too fast on that front.
Did George Ball have much of a role on any of these issues then, at this point, in the under Kennedy?
I can't really recall his playing a significant role or expressing his company. Was it McGee? Was it George McGee around?
I think he had some post.
There was something between McGee and Ball, and McGee said, if it gets involved with oil, then I can't really get involved because, if it's oil.
Right. His background in oil, yeah.
Yeah. So he tended not to be. What was McGee's position? It was something.
He was an assistant secretary or deputy secretary.
He was hired an assistant. He was a deputy of some level. Position.
No, he was a high official.
I can't remember George's rank in those days.
So, from 53 through 69, you were posted in South Asia, Bombay, as you said before, and then after Bombay, you were at
Colombo.
Then you went back to the State Department, in August 69, or summer 69, as country director.
Right.
How did that come about that you were appointed country director?
Of course, with the new administration, and the then country director, Ted Elliott, had been selected to become the executive secretary of the department, and the question obviously arose to replace him. And I know that Ted, among others, recommended to Joe Sisto that I be considered as a promising candidate. I happened to be on leave after 2 years in Ceylon in Washington, and Joe asked me to come in, and we talked, and as I recall, it was either our first or second meeting why he said that he would like me to come and replace Ted, who was going to be going up with his new job, which at the time was public, but that's neither here nor anyhow. And so I said, I was gratified. I'm glad to get back to Iranian affairs. I was very interested in the country and the people and liked it. I had only one caveat, is that I was going to leave our then ambassador and so on, and sort of we had some ongoing things there, which I was quite intimately involved in, and I felt that I had to sort of wind that down before I came back. So there was a couple months gap. And anyhow, I think I came on board in any effective way in September, and we had a new ambassador from Iran being appointed, or just arrived. We had a new ambassador, American ambassador, just, I've been on board, I don't know, a couple weeks, and Joe Sisko called me up to his office, and he said that there's a fellow sitting in the chair in his office, and said, Jack, I want you to meet our new ambassador to Iran, Doug MacArthur. And I thought, what have I done to deserve this? Because Doug, I don't know if you've heard this or not, but Doug had quite a reputation in the professional foreign services, a terribly difficult man with a ferocious temper, and he cut a pretty wide swath in his day. He influentially played cards with Eisenhower, you know, I mean, he's a big man. And as well as being, I think, if not our most senior, very close to our most senior career diplomat. And I sort of hoped as soon as we take Doug in hand. I must say, to his credit, he was just marvelous. Thoroughly professional. He listened. Obviously, he had questions and opinions of his own, but we got along famously, and from moment one, went to appointments that I made for him, said his piece, learned. It was not Douglas MacArthur of the reputation that I had, it was a corridor reputation that he had, as far as I was concerned.
Was he influential in making policy or revising or making recommendations on policy?
Sure, yeah. To the extent that ambassadors are.
Yeah.
And Doug probably a little more than some others, other than Dick Helms, just because of his past, past association, reputation, positions he held. I mean, he'd already been ambassador to about three or four countries before Iran, Japan, Belgium, where else? One or two others, yeah. I forgot. But, you know, as I say, if not the most senior, certainly career ambassador, there's only a handful of those to this day in our service. So more than a handful than my grandmother.
He started the car.
And married to the daughter of the Vice President of the United States. Probably.
I know that.
Oh, yeah.
Besides MacArthur, who were some of the major officials in the State Department under Nixon, State Department and elsewhere, who were involved in Iranian issues? Did Joe Sisko have a major role? Or?
Well, Joe was, of course, in institutional terms, the person of senior rank, most responsible, was Assistant Secretary for Near East and South Asian Affairs, which included Iran. But Joe was so deeply immersed in the Arab-Israeli issues and problems and formulation of policy for that country and negotiation that he didn't spend, wasn't able to spend very much time on Iranian affairs. So I would spend more time dealing with, reporting to, and getting guidance from and help from the Deputy Assistant Secretary, Roger Davies, who in the course of time I replaced. But Roger was the senior deputy in those days, and he was the one I dealt with the most. I did talk to Joe specifically and substantively on several occasions, I can remember, about the political situation in Iran or about the military sales to Iran. But it was not on any regular, sustained basis.
Do you get a sense that William Rogers had much interest in Iran, or was that, again, on the periphery, as far as he was concerned?
Yeah, I know you're going to talk to Ted Elliott, and I'm sure Ted can give you a much better insight than I can, because of his past association with Iran, and to what degree Rogers, to which Rogers had an interest in Iran. My perception, my vantage point was that, you know, it was just one of many, many, many things that he had to worry about. And he was not uninformed about it, but I don't feel that he was, except again, as any Secretary of State is bound to be with all the responsibilities he had, sort of in and out. If there was a major issue, then he was involved, but most of the time, no.
Well, under Nixon, there was a shift in power from towards the White House, away from the other departments, which is towards the NSC and Security Advisor Kissinger. Did this shift in authority and power have much impact on your role in the State Department, or how much you knew what was going on in terms of high-level policy? Can you measure that or assess that?
Well, it was soon evident that if one wanted to get things done, you had to be sure that the NSC was on board. Now, I was fortunate in that a longtime friend of mine, Hal Saunders, was in the NSC and covered Iran among other countries. And we had an excellent relationship. And as you probably know, Hal later came over to the State Department and eventually was the Assistant Secretary for Affairs and South Asian Affairs himself. But in those days, to the extent that the White House and the NSC was involved, I worked very closely with Hal, and fortunately we had a very excellent rapport and saw things very much the same way, by and large. And so, you know, things went, I didn't have a problem, in other words, with the NSC. And I suppose part of the explanation, quite beyond the personal relationship with Hal, was that I didn't have a problem with Kissinger's or Nixon's general outlook and approach toward Iran. In the context of the world environment in those days and so forth, I thought that it was a very wise, sound approach. And from my parochial point of view and my limited responsibilities of playing some kind of role in our, certainly our policy toward Iran, why, you know, I really didn't have a problem. As a matter of fact, I relied heavily in my bureaucratic battles on NSC support. And when push came to shove, as it did from time to time, I knew I knew that I could go to the White House. And so this was, I can remember specifically that I was getting an awful lot of flack from certain elements of defense on part of our military program. And I said, now look, I said, you know, we can hassle about this for the next 4 months, but sooner or later it's going to go to the White House. And you know what the answer is going to be. I know what the answer is going to be. So why don't we just save 4 months of time and agree right now? And that was that.
Should I ask this earlier? In terms of your roles, as a director, what were your basic responsibilities as country director for Iran? What were the basic responsibilities?
Without giving you a job description,
yeah.
Which in itself tends to be sort of a little nebulous,
yeah.
But country directors were, if they aren't still, sort of the key person in the U.S. government to look to in terms of our relations with any individual country. Because he's the one who sees all of the cables that go in and out, writes a lot of them himself, or his staff does. So he's a source of information, and as you know, particularly in Washington, information is power. So he's responsible for keeping your superiors involved and informed to the degree that you make a judgment about what is or is not important. You're servicing the embassy and the ambassador in the embassy in the field, being sure that their thoughts and recommendations are acted on within the bureaucracy. You're constantly doing battle with the other elements of the U.S. government that have something to do with our relations with Iran, whether it's the CIA or the Department of Atomic Energy, or the Pentagon, or Commerce, whatever. So you're spread out and have relations with the Washington community, as we now call it, in almost every respect. Where you have a country like Iran that has so many ties with the United States and so many interests, reciprocal interests. Deal with the Congress, you deal with staffers, so forth. Not an easy task.
But you pretty much saw all the cable traffic that came out of the State Department or came in on Iran. You reviewed it all as it came. At least the more major telegrams, the policy issues.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Or you helped draft them as they were issued.
Yes. Well, and this also not only involved cables to the State Department, but from other agencies that were sending messages to the embassy.
They had to consult you before they could
sign off on it. Yeah. And raise hell if they didn't ask by me. Occasionally somebody would try to